Then agenda paper number 7, reporting on other questions submitted, and I will hand over to Hagit.
Yes, thank you, Martin. So agenda paper 7 was constructed, I think, to provide additional benefit for the users of this discussion. So we have, as you know, the submission log that we included all the information about the submission that we received, but we thought this would provide a bit more information about those submissions. So agenda paper 7 covers all those questions that have been submitted but are not included in a separate agenda paper. So in this paper, we report to you on those submissions in 3 categories. So the first one is questions that we have received that can be answered applying only the words in IFRS 17. And for these ones, we have provided the answer together with a reference or additional explanation, hoping that it will be helpful or provide kind of educational support. The second group of submissions or questions we received do not meet the submission criteria. For this one, we provided you with a brief summary of that submission. And then on the third group, we have submissions and questions that we are considering taking through a different process other than the PRG, and you have the explanation there in that section. So we were not planning to go through each and every one of those together with you, so it's kind of a report, so it would be good if you want to reflect upon anything in specific. I do know that before we open this up, that we have heard and we understand that there is a bit of a discussion about, I think, a particular submission that is included in the second group, which is about the presentation on the balance sheet. So I think that this is something that you might want to pick up. So I don't know, Martin, if you want to add something before we end it open.
Yeah, only a short note, because man, I have also heard about the presentation issue quite a lot. And clearly it does not meet the criteria for the THG discussion, but I think, okay, it has a lot of interest in people thinking really the cost benefits are not in shape with this requirement. And I would suggest, because man, I personally have not understood why it is so costly to implement it on the one hand side, and on the other hand side also I don't understand why people think it has not any benefit, because usually to separate between assets and liabilities has benefit. It's one of the core principles in our accounting regime. And therefore, I would suggest maybe that, or I wanted to learn from THG members if they share this view and better understand, okay, what you think about the costs and the benefits about this requirement, and that we discuss it next time at the next THG in May. And then I think the next step is, because man, as you said, it does not meet the criteria, but I think we will inform the board of all kind of discussions which we have as THG. But if I bring that to the board and say, okay, people think, okay, that is too costly and to separate between assets and liability has not a benefit, I can promise you what the board will desire. Yeah, okay, it's different because it does not make a lot of sense. And therefore, I think we need some more information why it is so difficult, so costly, and also, but not only one-sided, why do you think, okay, it is not any beneficial than to separate these assets and liabilities. That is what I wanted to say to the specific items. Having said that, I think we open the discussion for any other comments on paper number 7. Kevin?
So Martin had a question which is maybe you partially answered it. And that is kind of, I guess, the status of these questions. So I guess there are some topics that are raised where yeah, the standard might be clear, but we think we'd like to talk about the issues with them. So maybe cost benefit is maybe how helpful they are. So if something is sort of dismissed here, is that almost like a, you know, non-interpretation of IFRIC, that it's kind of the issue is dealt with, or, you know, can we bring things back that are on? Question. I think you've said we can bring things back.
Well, I think the purpose is if there's things now that you want to flag, that's the purpose for asking you what your responses are to paper 7.
Okay. And I think it would be helpful if we could go through all of them, because I know that I certainly have more than one point where I'd like to highlight something like that.
Why don't you start by looking at the ones that you highlighted, Neil's highlighted.
Okay. So the first one, which is episode 4, subsequent treatment of contracts acquired in their settlement period. So this is where you basically say that if you take on some claims liabilities, then effectively you get your service period will cover the period from when you took on the business to the end of the claim settlement period. And I think while I agree that's what the standard says, there's definitely a lot of concerns raised and cost-benefit about this for a number of reasons. I guess the first reason is generally models today don't treat portfolio transfers in that way. There wouldn't be revenue on them. They're more like a sort of almost like a acquisition transaction. So you don't end up getting revenue. You just recognize you're bringing on a liability and you're making either a profit or a loss, which you may defer over time, but you're not getting revenue. And then the other thing is that because of the way it works, you could get some strange accounting where, you know, let's say an individual entity was acquired by a group, individual entity writes 1-year contracts. It can use the PAA, let's say, but then when it goes to the group, you say, oh, actually, this is a 10-year contract because we acquired you during this year, and then the same liabilities in the group can't use the PAA, whereas the individual can. So I think there's some strange outcomes of that, and it's very different to what we do today. So people have raised that is operationally difficult because it's new and it doesn't make a lot of sense compared to how things are done today. But yeah, I would agree that that's what the standard says.
To add to that, yeah, in this example, say a new contract is acquired, this is akin to an adverse development cover. So the implication is you need to set up a CSM, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it's contract, so that's the implication.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, directly to that comment, so I share the points of Kevin, and I really wonder of all the practical implications. I think that was a topic not in the focus in the implementation project as a first priority, but now I think when you read it here, I think you think through, and then a lot of topics come into my mind, like I need to set up a CSM for a kind of runoff portfolio and allocate the CSM. So what is the service here? Because we concluded that when we first provided, or the insurer, which then was acquired maybe by a group, first delivered the service, earned the CSM, now you acquire that insurer, and how the service is something different. Still, you provide the service to the same end customer, but firsthand you concluded that the service has been delivered. Now you deliver again a kind of service. What should be the pattern for the CSM? Insurance coverage is already gone. So a lot of, I think, secondary things and issues are coming up.
But isn't that usual to compare to other business combinations, Manuel? I remember from my old company, we had maybe 3 or 4 kind of different accountings, because when an entity was acquired by one entity, by a third entity, and so it ended up in 3 different amortizations and whatever.
And it's implications.
Always difficult if you have a business acquisition, because we have this kind of fresh start. Therefore, you have different, and clearly it would be easy if you simplify everything, but then we should forget
this combination. I think it's maybe the implication is a lot higher. So let's say you're moving from pre-allocation approach to building block general model. There's a really big operational difference between those two. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more around the CSM and revenue bit of it that makes it hard, you know, than saying, you know, bringing the business, it should be measured at the, you know, price, and that's the price you use. I think people are okay with that. It's more about making it now that the service changes from something that was a claim is now
it's revenue. It's also a business, man. If you acquire a bank which loans, you have totally different amortized costs and everything. There's a lot of, I think, operational work which you have to do. You have to maybe recalculate the whole retail portfolio. And you can forget your old amortized cost measures on that.
And your old impairment accounting.
Impairment accounting. That is not, I think, specific to insurance business.
Sorry, but Kevin is making a different point. We agree with what you say, but in equivalent terms of IFRS 17, there will still be unexpired coverage. The point that Kevin is making is that in this instance there isn't an expired coverage, and the staff is saying, well, the staff says,
it's a different coverage. So it's not coverage for the original.
You say implicitly we have now
for
done
the adverse development.
We have done, effectively, by buying this business, we have actually written a contract implicitly.
When you acquired in a business combination this portfolio of claims in the settlement period, you first need to assess whether there is insurance risk in them. And the insurance risk, when you look at it at this point, if there is significant insurance risk, it is for the adverse development. So this is how we look at the contract at this stage. So I think I realize that it might not come as natural to a lot of people in the industry because it's different than what we've done. But I think that this is where the standard takes us. And I realize that it has complexities, but at least for me, it's not that different from what I see in other industries when business combination involves. So I think I take a note of the complexity involved, and maybe it's not something that we used to, but I think we kind of, and in agreement that this is how we read the words in standard.
Roman and Kevin and I would actually draw your attention more than the complexity is the counterintuitive nature of the reported figures by the acquirer.
But because of where we come from with our old accounting, so this is why it's not natural. That's what I refer to.
The point is significantly broader than simply having to apply business combination accounting. And I really worry that this will distort M&A activity sector. So I think it's an area where I would suggest, if we may, can we bring back more evidence on the potential business consequences of this? To the staff.
So?
I can only echo Martin's caution, because I think that this is business combination accounting, and whenever you go out and talk to people about business combination accounting, they point to anomalies that arise simply because of acquisitions. If banks do acquisitions under IFRS 9, they're going to have to put 12-month losses on their entire loan book on the acquisition date. I mean, this is not unique to insurance. So, and I think we need to be careful not to sort of have a wish list of all the stuff we'd like to change in IFRS 17 because we're around this table. We're meant to be focusing on what do the words say, what's required. We can flag, you know, there's consequences, and as Martin said, we'll raise them with the board, but I think we need to be careful with expectations in terms of how much is up for grabs.
Maybe we underestimate that, Mary, but as I said, I have not only information which I think it is totally different to other industries, but maybe if you want to bring more new information, why not? I think we are open to that. Darren?
I was probably just going to say something very similar to Sue, but also to remind everybody that every new standard comes with inherent costs. Every new standard, by definition, means you're going to do things differently to the way you did them previously. And that is a part of moving, and I think a big part of what we're trying to do, what IFRS 17 is intended to do, is to mainstream insurance accounting, to bring it in line with others. And the example I thought about, because I've heard quite a lot about it recently, is the what happens when a bank buys another bank's book under IFRS 9. And there are a number of repercussions there. Purchased impaired credit and all these sorts of things come into play. That means that there's difference in accounting below and above.
Roberta?
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that is what the standards say, and there are consequences. I would just caution, I think within the insurance industry, we do have multiple transactions when we have subsequent shifting around of stuff within common control, and that might be slightly different. So I just put a marker down that I agree with externally, this is the consequence. Yeah. I'm not sure I agree that that's a consequence for common control.
So at least we add this also under number B. But
I just wanted to agree on that SO4 point. I think there are people are looking at this and probably didn't see the implications of this before. and now it's being understood, it needs to be looked at more clearly, because you are potentially going forward double dipping on revenue across the industry. You're going to have recognised revenue based on the risk that was originally underwritten, and then you're going to re-recognise again after the portfolio transfer. So that, I think, to your point, Mary, about that potential for M&A activity and the impact it could have on that is not to underestimate, and we do need to look at it.
But remember, an important thing here is that the accounting and the intention of accounting standards is to represent the entity's perspective. And from your entity perspective, you have acquired something that is going to deliver profit or losses. And so recording that, you may be double-dipping across the industry. In other words, two people may have recognized the same revenue, but from an entity perspective, that's not the case.
I just would like to maybe say it differently, but the point I would like to tell you, at least, is we understand what the standard says, but this appears to be counterintuitive to many people, even when they understand what it is. And so my recommendation personally is don't say, well, it's just normal, because it isn't. In one place you have revenue, in the other place you don't. It is what you want, and it's clear, and you can say that's what you want and that is clear, but don't try to, my recommendation again, then you can just throw it away, don't just say it's the same everywhere else, because it isn't. Loans are loans in the bank that sells it, in the bank that buys it. This is different. The insurance company that sells it doesn't have any revenue at all. The one that buys it will begin having revenue. So that's very, very different.
People have said it is operationally burdensome and costly, and that was my response. And you were saying now it is counterintuitive. I have not understood why it is counterintuitive, but we said
because in one place there is revenue.
We can bring it back, I think, for the next meeting, and then we learn more. Okay. Any other points?
S23.
Yeah.
So this was, and again, I agree that's what the standard says, that when you're applying the PPAA, the basis of recognising the liability for remaining coverage is on premiums received. But again, this one I think is a significant issue for many general insurers who are going to carry their accounts on the PAA approach. What it requires us to do is to be able to isolate the cash-based accounting. I don't know there are many insurance systems out there where policy and insurance contract information is actually tied into the cash receipting system. And this is actually a much bigger issue than it looks. It looks fairly straightforward. I understand why you want to put it in there to try and align it to the general model, but it creates a huge amount of operational impact. And for that reason, I would like to see that one. You noticed that you said in here that was a number 27, which was, I'm aware, is one that's come out of the Australian industry. It's been agreed across the Australian industry, and that really highlights the issues coming out of this. One of the, looking at this as the general insurer, when you ask me what my liability for remaining coverage is, it's the liability I have to provide, the obligation I have to provide cover to my policyholders. The outcome you get under here is depending on that, how that policyholder is going to pay their policy and whether they've chosen a monthly payment plan or an annual upfront plan is going to make a difference to my liability for remaining coverage, but my obligation to that policyholder hasn't changed. So I think it's important to look at the insurer's obligations in this, and it's just given, again, a counterintuitive outcome, because what I've effectively done is taken the liability for remaining coverage being the way I would look at it now, which is the unearned premium, and it's effectively offsetting all my trade receivables against that. So it's effectively netted off two kind of significant important asset liability in my balance sheet. And this one I think also ties into SO3, which is around the balance sheet disclosures, because this is one of the key difficulties that you're faced with when you're trying to determine what is a net insurance asset and an insurance liability, because you have to create all these netting off at a very granular level to do that. And it really is not the way systems and processes are set up. So I think there's a huge operational impact in this piece. And I think actually many people are only just coming to this now. And I think part of having it on this reporting issues in 7 is going to actually highlight to people that it exists. I think it's just you don't really understand it until you push through and see how you aggregate up your financial statements and you look at the financial statements, and it's really only in the balance sheet that you're required to have this disaggregation to a group level for both the assets and the liabilities. All of the notes and the disclosures you can actually look at a more entity-based level. So it's really where the balance sheet is the driving problem behind that, and this is just one of the issues that relate to that.
So that is linked to the issue that we discuss next time.
Yes, I agree with what Anne said, but I guess that this point may have also an impact for the building block approach and for the value of fee approach. So it seems that it is introducing a different way of recognizing receivables, and so currently all the actuarial models calculating future cash flows read the actual cash flow when it's due, not when it's effectively paid. And I guess that this conclusion also related to the long-term business would create a lot of operational complexity, because it's not only a question for me of netting receivable within a technical provision, because then we have unit of account grouping to be fulfilled. So it's something that may create a lot of operational issues, and I'm not 100% sure that it is an improvement in terms of presentation.
Any other issues, comments? Please.
So I, not this paper, but we move to another one, is it okay?
We move to?
Another one.
Another item,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the other question about S20, building contracts using the modified prospective approach to transition. Because the question is because there is a similar, but not identical, text on C23 for the fair value approach, and we were thinking about submitting this matter, but given that these were submitted for the modified, I decided to raise this verbally today. It's unclear in C23 whether the second paragraph, the one with the shell, is actually mandating a particular view. In other words, if you have information as to when those contracts were issued, and therefore you can actually group them by annual cohorts. Is C23 effectively telling you that you must group them?
Yes. Okay. So there is a difference between the fair value approach and the modified retrospective approach. Under the modified retrospective approach, which is the submission that we have received, you need to first consider whether you have the available information, and if you do, you need to use that.
And in the other case?
Then you'll have a release. In the fair value approach, it's more open.
So even if you know when you sold and you lost everything else, because often that's the one piece of data that can be there, I can still group more than 12 months on fair value. So then the second sentence really is subordinate to the first sentence in the paragraph that says you can group more than 12 months. And then, but then the second sentence becomes a bit kind of redundant. So we couldn't figure out how to read that second sentence then if it is subordinate to the first one.
So I think in terms of if it's redundant or not, it really depends on practice and whether you can you have this information or not. I think it's something that we cannot determine for others. But I think that if you look at how we developed those different transition approaches, the fair value was a relief, a first start, and we allowed the choice there. And under the modified retrospective approach, we were trying to get to something as close as possible to a retrospective application, providing reliefs in places that we don't have enough information. So I think it works fine with this distinction between them. And this is the clarification we provided in S20.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for also extending it to C23. That's very helpful.
Good, Leslie.
Just to point out that SO9 is the point that I raised that we actually got the clarification on. So.
Yes, another point, the S26. So the end, it's I guess it's a very important point because many of participating contracts in Europe, in the continent, are the sharing of the profit on an annual basis based on cost or on tariff cost. And I agree with the message. It was also in line with my expectation. But let's say, considering that it would be very relevant because we are talking about classification and granting of measurement model to the contracts, I'm wondering if it's possible to introduce some flexibility in the response, because I understand that since the question is put in negative, also the answer is put in negative, but it seems that let's say the entity is required to demonstrate that on the long-term basis there is an identical the benefit assigned to policyholder reflect the fair value. This is, quite easy to demonstrate on a principle-based approach, but the danger that I see is that a strict interpretation of this working may require some excessive proof or quantification in order to classify this kind of contract under the variable fee approach that seems to me very sensible. So.
I think I understand your point, and I think that we were quite open in responding to this one because the question was drafted in a way that if the contract provides a shared benefit based on accounting that is based on book values and not fair value, does it mean that I don't meet the variable fee approach? And the answer is that not necessarily, but we can't take off the judgment and the consideration from practice. So I cannot guarantee that in any case you will end up in the variable fee approach. It is an assessment that you will need to do, but we are saying that the mere fact that you share the returns based on a measurement that is not fair value does not mean that you are out of the variable fee approach, and I think it's reflected in this way. I don't know if what I said helpful for you, but we're not taking that judgment away.
No, yeah, but let's say, I guess, that you have to check the same criteria that are included in the standard. So the fact that I share on amortized cost basis with the annual, on the annual basis, it does not require to mean additional demonstration compared to what is...
So the same criteria for variable fee approach or meeting the scope are applied. So we need to consider those criteria. I hope this is helpful.
Okay, so then I have another one. S24, discount rates apply to the CSM for contracts without direct participation features. So that's clear now with the response. The basic conclusions were not really commenting on why the ISB wanted to have these different accretion rates, the one that has been used to calculate the CSM in the first place, and I was hoping that perhaps so someone may be able to tell us why that is good, because we struggle to understand why you have to accrete at a rate which is different to the one you used to calculate the CSM in the first place. So just for the benefit of everyone, so the contracts that have asset-dependent cash flows but fail the variable fee approach will have a CSM which is calculated based on asset-dependent discount rates. Paragraph 72, B72, requires the accretion on the CSM for those contracts at the rate which is effectively a nominal rate, effectively a top-down, bottom-up, which is not asset-dependent. So you have a difference in discount rates, usually lower, to reverse the effect of time value money on the CSM. So that means that technically you have a different revenue to the one that you would have had if you were using the discount rate that was used to calculate the CSM in the first place, which is the case for all other contracts. But for this fairly material category of insurance contracts, this requirement would appear to create an anomaly, at least in my eyes. And it is clear. There is no doubt, and the response makes it clear, but because apart from the response, I don't have another basis to understand the rationale. I want to see whether today or maybe next time
Or we can just, in the final version, just put the reference into the basis where we think it describes it.
Yeah. Well, maybe, yes, because I look at it and I couldn't find an obvious one, then maybe, because I don't know what is it that you meant.
BC 273.
BC 273.
Yeah. For the sake of simplicity, the board decided the rate should be a rate applicable to nominal cash flows that do not vary based on assets.
I couldn't be, but that's not, there is no simplicity gain here.
That is what the board thought.
you're calculating another rate. So if anything, is a greater burden, because I've already done the calculation to come to my CSM with the asset dependent discount rate. Then I have to calculate another one for accretion. So again, that's why I discarded that one as the valid explanation. I said there must have been another one.
I think it's simpler. I think it's much simpler. So I don't agree with Francesca.
Thank you. But it is in the basis.
So that's it. Then there's
so this
simplicity.
Is the requirement, and this is what the board decided when the standard was finalized. So I think that this is what we have.
Okay.
With this.
And we are not alone.
Never.
I'd like to see her results reported on this basis, then we'll see what she says.
Okay, any other?
Yeah.
Not the case, then we go to admin.
Do you want to kind of sum up where we ended up with this? So I think we provided some helpful clarification. There are two or three potential topics that we might bring back to kind of hear more about the outreach. And people thought about implementation concerns.
That's what we got there. Yeah, I have an additional point, but because in the afternoon session we had a lot of where people think of the standard word saying what the words it is, how it we describe it, but we want to have a change because of operational cost does not make sense, whatever issues. And I think if we continue in this way, then we maybe after the second or third meeting, we have 10, 15 issues we are using support or should change the standard because it is too difficult and too burdensome. And I can promise you that will not happen because we cannot and will not discuss, 10, 15, 20 issues because we have finalized the standard, we have discussed it 20 years. And if that is the expectation, I think, then we have another expectation gap. And I thought, we are open if we have done something wrong, if we have done something which we were not informed, and a lot of issues is, it's operational burdensome. Yes, we know that. Read the effect analysis, it is very sad, that is a totally new standard for some insurance companies more than for others, and it will include costs. And cost is operational burdensome, and we understand that, and that was the board was aware when we have done the standard. And therefore, I think really then, if we will not close this discussion on operational burdensome and costly, but it needs some more convincing, better information which we were not aware of. And clearly, in every kind of new standard is burdensome, it is costly. If you speak to banks now about IFRS 9, they will also say it's costly, it's burdensome. If you speak to chemical industry about IFRS 15, they will also say it is costly, it is burdensome. And that is not something unique to insurance. And also, as I said, we have not discussed the standard so long as for insurance with so many input. And I'm struggling when we continue in this way what we should do with this and we collect 15, 20 issues, which we... You think, it is costly and burdensome, and what is then the next step? Because it's my personal opinion. I don't speak for the whole board. I personally think the board will not open the standard for 15, 20 issues. And so is also, I think, green to me. And therefore, I think really we should concentrate really in this discussion on the big issues and not have, I would not say nitty-gritty, but clearly, people would try to have a chance with this THG to say, maybe there is an issue, but is it, is it a big issue or is it a normal issue which has to do with implementing a new standard? That I think we have to distinguish, and therefore I think we have you here, because you are the experts and helping really to get this implemented. But it is not a kind of, I would say, a session which we gather a lot of difficulties. Yeah. And maybe some is more than difficulties, we should discuss that, but not any. Maybe that was too harsh what I have said, but I had a little bit the impression that if we continue in this way, that we will not achieve a lot with this. Martin, anyone want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I understand and accept what you're saying, but I think, you know, it's also our responsibility to bring the issues to you that we're seeing in implementation.
Yeah.
I think the ones we've identified today actually are big issues, and I think particularly the three on paper seven, they all really arise from the non-life industry, and I think the non-life industry has not really been following the end discussions of the RSB for some time, because you really were solving variable fee approach, you know, which is really not applicable to them. So I think many of them, and I think Anne would say QVE was probably one, actually realized some of the stuff for the first time when the standard came out. So, you know, I don't think we intend to bring up issues that we know you've discussed 100 times and, you know, the implications are known, but these, the ones on these papers, I think the three, feel like things which are relatively new. And, you know, anytime I go and speak to someone in the non-life industry, they're like, that's insane, you know, like, why are we doing this? So we just bring it to you on that basis, recognizing that you may, you know, not decide to change, and of course you're not going to make 15 different changes, but we feel like those are the big ones.
Okay.
Can I just comment then as well? And I think there are two things at play. One is you realise some of these very significant issues as you move through your process of, you know, identifying how you build up your financial statements, what they look at like at the end, and then how you bring all the information in to derive that. So, you know, people are really just coming to that realisation as they're going through their IFRS 17 project. But there's a whole rump of people out there as well who haven't got to this stage. So I think, you know, we're here to find solutions as well. I think these are really critical issues. I don't think you can multiply it by three for every TRG that we'll have. I think this balance sheet disclosures and the related issues to that are one of the single most significant issue I'm seeing in the non-life industry. So, you know, they're not brought lightly, and they're brought with experience of having actually driven through and tried in practice.
Okay,
Joe? Yeah, I don't think we can underestimate the operational complexity and the time it's taking, you know, for GI and life, I mean, right across all markets, but for items where we're seeing where it's not making much difference to the numbers, you know, it's really hard to justify internally, it's just difficult to be having to do something where you can't see a lot of benefit, and it's very expensive.
One thing I'd love to encourage the members of the TRG to think about for next time, which I don't think happened so much today, and maybe it's just because of the issues and because it's a new group. I think what was particularly helpful when we had the impairment group, which I know most closely, was when we got into a situation where there were particular words that needed to be applied that required judgment, and where the members actually gave practical examples of how they were reading the words and how they were going about it from an operational perspective to apply the words in a standard in a way that worked for them, that helped people think through the issues and the systems and how they'd approached it from a practical perspective. Because I think one of the things we really want to be able to use this group for is exactly to your point, Anne, about how, you know, we're sort of all up to here in IFRS 17, maybe you're up to here in IFRS 17, but there's lots of people in the market who are really just starting, and they're just trying to get used to the to what's in the standard. And so one role of this group is to make us aware of issues, but another role is really to try and help the people who are listening to these webcasts to think through how they're going to implement and to get the benefit of what you guys are doing on a day-to-day basis. And I don't think we did that today. And I think in the future it would be great to think of ways to bring that aspect of the group out more to provide the educational benefit to the market.